Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Chris Hamm, Director of the Federal Systems Integration and Management Center, FedSIM. Also joining us from IBM is Tom Vertke. So, Chris, many folks who are listening are familiar with certain business functions that the government performs, sort of finance, accounting, IT, but maybe not so much procurement. Would you give us an overview of the key elements of the acquisition management process? What is procurement in the federal space?
This is one of those where I want to do a video that's like the how a bill becomes a law.
That's a great one.
Just to be able to show people the process steps on why it takes so long. I do, you know, some sort of role reversal training with some industry folks just to show them all of the paperwork that we create. The acquisition process generally starts with somebody has an idea on how to do something. They've got to get permission in order to go ask for money. They're going to go through the budget process, write up business cases on mm-hmm. how they're going to get funding. And so they have a vested interest in, I want to deliver something. So they go through the budget process that takes, you know, sometimes many years, but at least a year for them to start to get approval to do, if it's a new effort, new funding. And once they have their money, that's when they're suddenly realizing, I need help to buy this. An internal procurement shop will be assigned to do the work, or if they were seeking outside support, somebody like FedSIM, then, you know, they'd be talking to us. It all starts with having their approved budget. And once you have a budget, there are a couple of things when you're starting an acquisition that seem meaningless but actually take up a lot of time. The first thing you have to do is decide whether or not what's the overall dollar amount for it and whether or not it's suitable for small business. The first step in almost all acquisitions is a set-aside determination on whether or not it's going to go automatically to small business or potentially to not to small business, to large business. So you have to do an RFI and a justification to say that the paperwork, you know, of which size company is the right kind of company to start with. The next step is see whether or not you have to consolidate any requirements from anything else. There's a rule in the government that consolidation of two or more small is bad, or if you're just combining two things, you know, it affects the supplier base. So there's a separate document that documents whether or not you're consolidating. Once you have those two things, then you have to write an acquisition plan. The acquisition plan is a rather prescriptive, lengthy document. I think the ordinary one that we'll write is probably 25 pages, explaining all of the nuances of the acquisition. Who did it before? What's the underlying outcome? What's your schedule? Whether or not – and there's some things in there that are like vestigial from the past, like a make or buy decision, like if we're buying a ship, should we make the ship or should we buy the ship? All sorts of the little questions that make sense, but when you add them in aggregate, there's like 17 different components of it. You'll have multiple reviews to get an acquisition plan approved. And then once you get through all of those reviews, then you've got to start actually focusing on the thing that it is that you started out doing of the requirements of what you're buying. That's normally a month or two long process of requirements definition, writing a statement of work or a requirements work document, some sort of version of here's what I need. And there will be a team of people that are documenting that. And then there's a corresponding sister activity there. The contracting officer and contracting specialist are putting a wrap around the whole thing. That's a lot of the things that you would see in an ordinary contract, like how are we going to price it? What are the deliverables? What are the evaluation criteria? To get all of that completed, that 2 or 3 month process, it goes through a bunch of reviews. There's lawyers everywhere, and this is no exception. Lawyers are going to review just about every document that's spending significant money, making sure that we're following the rules. Once that's completed, there's some associated smaller documents that you'll also create, and then you'll put that thing out to industry to bid. The default position is you should put things out for at least 30 days just to let companies have an opportunity to prepare a response and make sure that you're getting, you know, competition. DoD has a specific rule here where it's got to have a response from 3 or more or 30 days. And then after that, then you're getting to the which company's proposal is the best. You can evaluate them many different ways, you know, written proposals, oral presentations. We even do some videos submitted back. Picking the one that meets the requirements the best, and then writing up what turns out to be a very lengthy technical report and a corresponding very detailed cost analysis in a what's called an award decision document to basically justify all of the things that you went through that your decision was sound. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of time and attention that goes into the writing of those two documents to make sure that they are unassailable so that if you were to get protest, that's what the decision is going to hang on, that documentation. So that's why it takes a couple of months, you know, in that 6 to 7 month time frame from start to finish, where a lot of it isn't focused on what is the person wanted to buy in the first place and how well they did it. It's probably only 20 or 30% that, and the rest is paperwork exercise to get it through the wickets.
You've mentioned that you positioned FedSIM as a one-stop shop for large complex acquisitions. And to that end, I'd like to get a sense of your key strategic goals and priorities.
My office only has a very small percentage of the overall IT spend. It's never going to be a lot. But I do think that my office or offices like mine should be better positioned to do things that agencies don't have to create their own contracts themselves. Mm-hmm. Each agency is kind of known for creating its own MAC. It's a multiple award contract, or if they're one of the special ones, they can create a GWAC contract. And so they're duplicating the effort of organizations that have already created them. They should be using Alliant or OASIS or other, you know, GWAC, NIH, CIOSP, yeah. NASA SOUP. Those things take a lot of the time and energy out of buying. So each agency should just be putting a storefront around those vehicles and calling them their own rather than the Air Force has been trying to create a vehicle called NetSense for about 3 years. That doesn't seem like a good idea to me. Maybe if I was, you know, in charge of the NetSense vehicle for Air Force, it would. But what I want people to do is to recognize that acquisition has a cost. And so they should be trying to balance that cost with the service delivery of their underlying mission. I would like to do more work. I think that, you know, my office does a particularly very good job on doing large IT acquisition and now some large professional services acquisition. And it doesn't have to be my office. You know, create an office like my office within each agency that specializes in doing their complex buys. Rotate people around different agencies, but find a way to focus on tying that mission to the large complex things that are going to catch people up in these multi-year kind of protests where they're really, really sticky.
So as a follow-up, what are some of the key internal and external drivers and trends that have shaped and informed your strategic direction? And would you briefly highlight some of the core initiatives you're pursuing to meet those priorities?
Well, cybersecurity has been a huge driver for us because of the recent leaks in information, my own personal information, for example. So I would like to continue the good work that we're doing on the CDM program. I think a major growth area for us is going to be in the professional services area. There was a contract that was awarded called OASIS that I originally thought would be a replacement vehicle for some work that was going on under MOBIS or PEZ or LogWorld, but mostly like lower dollar labor contract kind of work. It turns out that there's a really large unmet need for an expertise in buying large, complex professional services. We did a lot of these as IDIQ contracts in the past. We have two major programs, one with the Joint Improvised Explosive Device Defeat Organization and one with CDC, where they're taking a combination of people and stuff that you couldn't really do effectively under the GSA schedule program because you didn't have the ability to do cost reimbursement style contracting. You couldn't do some of the post-award buying of materials. And so I'll give you an example where this has become, you know, very, very meaningful for the Defense Department. If you want to train people on how to defeat IEDs, you need to get experts and who know how to do that. And you need to have things that are not generally commercially available, like abandoned cars and kitty litter. You want to plug those two things together. You can't plug those together on the same contract because they're not the same thing. Mm-hmm. So you have to have a company that can do the purchasing for those things on an as-needed basis. And when the threat changes, that they can correspond and change and buy the things that they need to buy 2 years from now that we haven't imagined because they've reacted to it. You can't do that on a firm fixed price basis or on a labor hour basis. You have to have a company that could go out and do the purchasing for you. Be like, all right, this time it's plastic water bottles that are going to be the threat. So let's figure out how to do that. So we've seen that kind of requirement shifting on professional services. So now most of our new work for these entities is going to be like an OASIS-style task order where we hire a company and they provide the underlying requirements and the stuff that you're going to be buying.
Chris, what does it mean that FedSIM provides full-service lifecycle support to federal agencies? And would you be able to elaborate on the activities and services provided to your government clients?
The best way I can describe the focus on the post-award is it's an actual customer service. When somebody needs something, or even when they don't, when we're just in post-award, I have a resource that is dedicated to that program, that sits with that program, attends their meetings. When they call at 7 o'clock at night, they're answering the phone, they're returning the phone call. They're supporting the mission of that agency. A lot of our folks end up collecting badges, like they're proud of, going native and working at that other agency. But It's such a different experience than what people get whenever they're working with an in-house contracting shop, or at least most in-house contracting shops, where it's such a hands-off relationship there where, you know, they send something over and they don't know where it is, and it's a 30-day process before they get reviewed and submit. Mm-hmm. Whereas my folks are so actively in their supporting their engagement that they become part of the team and they actually feel customer service for the first time in an area from a government service provider. So that helps that person focus on what the outcome of the contract is, while I'll have a staff behind the scenes that's they're reviewing every invoice. So that part is for the most fun, is when you're actually delivering something and helping that agency get to the outcome. So that's why a lot of our folks, they'll come in, they'll work on an assignment for maybe 2 or 3 years. Once the project is completed, then they move on to another agency working on a new engagement. So they're getting, you know, refreshed skills around each different technology they're working on, and they're staying in the office because I'm giving them an opportunity to move from agency to agency to agency.
Great answer and great philosophy. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how many customers does FedSim have today, and what is the typical FedSim customer profile?
We have 140 active projects today. The default would be every branch of the service. Anybody in the military, we've got some sort of customer engagement with them, but you know, it's so large that nobody would cover the entire full suite of DOD. Our largest are probably at the joint level, you know, things with the Department of Defense directly, less so with the Navy. We have a lot of Air Force work and we have a lot of Army work, and I think that those are definitely going to continue. Within the civilian market, it's the couple that I mentioned before, just DHS, FDIC, GSA, and agriculture. The projects tend to have an overall similarity. They're almost always a client that has the ability to influence where they're getting their service provided from. You know, if the answer is, you know, doesn't matter, you're doing it with our internal shop, obviously my office could never get engaged in there. So they've got to have something that trumps any sort of internal turf or politics. So for us, that tends to be mission.
I know that FedSim considers itself to be vehicle agnostic, but what types of contracts and contract vehicles are at your disposal for use in meeting the demands of agency clients?
I'm not sure if everybody at GSA will be a fan of me saying this, but We are truly vehicle agnostic. Now, fortunately, GSA creates some of the best vehicles out there, so I'm going to use a bunch of them. But if a customer requirement comes in that is best suited out of NASA soup, you know, they have a very low fee, they're, you know, very effective at doing some of the IT commodity purchasing, we would use NASA soup in a heartbeat. You know, just write a memo and say why soup is best, put it in your acquisition plan, proceed. In terms of creating contracts ourselves, we're not in the contract vehicle creation business as a default. That's the other part of GSA that makes the GSA schedules and the GWACs and the MACs. For that DHS requirement for cyber, we have a $6 billion BPA with a bunch of different providers on it that's available government-wide, so any other government entity could use it if they were going to do the ordering directly themselves. But that's not going to be the default for us. We're going to be looking at existing vehicles and then trying to execute rapidly under those vehicles rather than create our own.
So when you mentioned this earlier, and honestly, when you get into contracts and contract vehicles types, you know, it can get into alphabet soup. But you mentioned one particular OASIS. I think it was one acquisition solution for integrated services contract. How are you bringing new agencies as users into this contract vehicle, and how is sort of the innovation around the discovery market research tool helping that?
I like to think that I'm right most of the time, but on this one, I was completely wrong.
Really?
I really did think that there wasn't much of a market for this contract when they first started discussing it. OASIS was originally called Integrations in some of the, you know, like 2005 kind of time frame of creating a agency contract that would be for the entire government. And I really did think it was going to be a low-dollar labor hour kind of replacement vehicle for MOBIS, PES, LogWorld, the GSA scheduled professional services work. It was a completely unmet need where there's nothing but blue sky ahead of using the OASIS contract. Some of it's due to the relationship on what contract types you could do on GSA schedule. And some of it is agencies, by default, were just doing their own IDIQs, which we weren't even aware of what their market spend looked like until a couple of years ago. where they would be, you know, if it's professional service, separately, they would hire people by the hour, labor hour, time and materials kind of work, and then they would go out separately and buy whatever it is, and then the government would serve as its own integrator. We would piece the thing together and build it. The Air Force is probably most commonly known for that kind of style of contracting. OASIS came. And suddenly, we had two major acquisitions initially for OASIS. We announced that we were doing them, and we were going to try and focus on doing these large professional services buys, where they're also going to buy the piece parts and build the outcome for the client agency. And suddenly, it exploded. Wow. Customers, particularly in the Department of Defense, are calling their friends in other parts of the Department of Defense and referring that work to us, saying, "Did you know that there's this thing where you can do cost plus, award fee, or incentive fee style contracting, where this office will do it for you?" And right now we have a program that's out on the street I probably shouldn't say the specific number, but it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars for training around IEDs with a couple of clients in the military. And I would have never imagined that we would have something on that size and scale for professional services. There turns out that the spending on professional services is about as much as it is on IT, and there's less competition. There's a ton of IT vehicles. There are very few government-wide professional services vehicles. And I think that that's really where we're going to try and corral the way that the government's spending money and try to make it more efficient and focus it much more on getting the outcome rather than getting the best hourly rate on a person or on the stuff. Buying the outcome is where you need to get to on that.
How is FedSIM changing the way government does business? We will ask its director, Chris Hamm, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.